On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Hockenberry, and this is On Point. If the world could talk, what would it say to humans about our impact on the planet? Perhaps the voices of warning and the signs of change are all around us, and humanity is just not listening. Does humanity value the diversity and richness of nature? Will we miss it when, if it goes away? Somberly watching nature go and passionately seeking a way to mobilize humanity to save it is biologist E.O. Wilson. His new book, Creation, is an eloquent plea to find a common language for understanding, revering, and protecting nature. Joining me now is E.O. Wilson. He is professor of biology emeritus at Harvard University, where he has been teaching for 50 years. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, is the recipient of the National Medal of Science, is considered one of the world's most important voices in the conservation movement, and has authored more than 20 books, including one of my favorites about ants, but I don't want to go on and on about that. His most recent is called The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, John. Oh,
it's great to have you here. Well, you know, this book is interesting because it is literally directed to a particular character, as though in almost a Socratic way you're trying to convince someone to join you. And indeed, the first chapter is titled Letter to a Southern Baptist Pastor, Salutation. Would you read a bit from the opening there, please?
Yes, I will. This is directed apostrophically to, a Southern Baptist pastor because I came up in that culture, because I have a desire to enlist, if it can be done, the religious community who have the moral fervor and the muscle to make a big difference. But it's also directed to a broader audience, including those who might want to know about or should know about the condition of the biodiversity and how we can get education more closely aligned with the needs of conservation and understanding nature. So the letter to a Southern Baptist pastor has its salutation, including, I write to you now for your counsel and help. Of course, in doing so, I see no way to avoid the fundamental differences in our respective worldviews. You are a strict interpreter of Christian Holy Scripture. You reject the conclusion of science that mankind evolved from lower forms. You believe that each person's soul is immortal, making this planet a way station to a second eternal life. Salvation is assured those who are redeemed in Christ. I am a secular humanist. I think existence is what we make of it as individuals. There is no guarantee of life after death, and heaven and hell are what we create for ourselves on this planet. There is no other home. Humanity originated here by evolution from lower forms over millions of years, and yes, I will speak plain. Our ancestors were ape-like animals. The human species has adapted physically and mentally to life on Earth and no place else. Does this difference in worldview separate us in all things? It does not. You and I and every other human being strive for the same imperatives of security, freedom of choice, personal dignity, and a cause to believe in that is larger than ourselves. Let us see, then, if we can, and if you're willing, to meet on the near side of metaphysics in order to deal with the real world we share. I put it this way because you have the power to help solve a great problem about which I care deeply. I hope you have the same concern.
E.O. Wilson reading from his new book, The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. You know, implicit in your calling there is the notion that scientists do not have the engagement of the people, do not have the attention of people in the same way that the religious community has. I'm wondering why that is the case.
Most scientists who are, you know, contributing to original research are secularist, and they provide the information that we need to plan for the future of the environment. But this is a rather complicated subject. It's easy to understand toxic pollution. It's easy to understand climate warming, relatively easy, and ozone depletion in the higher atmosphere. These things have been grasped, and I think they have even engaged the mainstream of the people, and including religious believers, including evangelicals, who have started movements to enter this into the political process, as well as moral teaching of the magisterium. In the case of the creation, though, we're talking about the living world, and this is not an easy subject to get your mind around right away as to why, if, say, two of the five rhinoceros species in the world, for example, went extinct, which is a good possibility in the next 20 years, why that really matters to them as American, or and particularly as religious believers with a different worldview. So that is what the problem is. The scientists are in a very small minority. The three leading humanist organizations, to which many of them are likely to belong, if they belong to any organization of this nature at all, has a membership totaling about 5,000 versus in the National Association of Evangelicals, for example. The leading group of organized group of evangelicals, there are 30 million.
Yeah, 5,000 is a small congregation, I believe.
It's not the size group that really has a lot of power in the political process.
Well, you don't frame your call as an argument. You're definitely enlisting allies in a journey to try to both understand the world's ecological diversity and to try to save it. And one of the things that comes out of your book, I think, that's really fascinating is how accessible the wilderness, the pre-human wilderness, is. You describe in there visiting by boat mangrove forests in Florida. And I can really see a transportation back, not 10 years ago, 20 years ago, to the pre-industrial age, but literally millions of years ago. What do you see when you look at a mangrove forest in Florida?
I see deep history. If you're, for example, interested in particular in what the deep history of Florida is, particularly South Florida, beyond relatively recent human occupation, you need only go down U.S. 1, down that mall strip, where it appears that all of nature virtually has been removed, but then take a 14-footer off into the bay where there are little mangrove islands, and you're soon in a virgin forest, red mangrove, so that with a very rich fauna and flora, very similar to the way it would have been 10,000 years ago. And that is an experience worth having. I hope everyone would like to have it. And actually, you can do that almost casually and for a next-to-nothing expense as one stopover in the Florida Keys. Unfortunately, and this to make the point, mangrove forests of this kind are being destroyed very rapidly all around the world in the part of the overdevelopment of wetlands.
You know, you learn a lot of interesting facts whenever I read your work. But in this particular book, you describe that most of the large mammals, of which humans are in that group, are already extinct on the planet?
That's a difficult figure to hit upon, because we don't know how many small mammals became extinct. I think the correct statement is that the great majority of very large mammals, the megafauna,
megafauna,
are extinct. The evidence points pretty clearly to the first arrival of humanity, wherever that is, Australia 60,000 years ago, the New World, maybe 12,000 to 15,000 years ago, very roughly, Madagascar, close to 2,000 years ago, New Zealand, 1,000 years ago. And whenever that's happened, there's a wave of extinction of the large mammals and in some cases, the giant birds.
Humans show up, megafauna beware.
That's right. Only a little fragment is able to hang on. As, for example, in the United States, we have pronghorn antelopes, and we have, fortunately, at the last minute, we pull the buffalo back. But what we have today is a tiny, tiny fraction of what was there, shall we say, 12,000 years ago.
You describe Hawaii as America's extinction capital?
Yes. It's one of the hottest of the hot spots in the world. That is to say, where a rich fauna, or what used to be a rich fauna, has largely been wiped out. For example, in the case of Hawaii as a whole, there were archaeologists have found by going through recent deposits with bird bones that 125 or more birds, wide variety including eagles and flightless ibises and giant goose-like birds and so on, lived on Hawaii and then began to disappear rapidly when the first Polynesians arrived, and then even more what was left when the first European and other colonists arrived. And today the 125 has shrunk to 25, almost all of which are endangered. That's reflected, or that is typical, of a lot of the fauna and flora of Hawaii. Most of what you see when you come into Honolulu and they put the leis around your neck or all around you are alien birds, alien plants, not the true Hawaii.
Wow. From Wrens, Georgia, Steve is calling. You're on the air, Steve.
Yes, I just wanted to call and comment. I do enjoy the point you're making, but the scientists and explorers are basically, in my mind, following God had created Adam for, that is, to name all things. That's my only comment. I'll listen in on the radio.
Right? All right. Thanks, Steve. Mm-hmm.
Quick remark. Yes. My point in making this book, I think I'm the only one so far that chose to take this track, is to say it doesn't matter where you believe it came from. Let us put that aside, and let us put aside, if we can, a lot of the culture wars that have astoundingly developed between organized religion on one side and on secular science and humanism on the other side. Put it aside and find common ground. Science and religion are the two most powerful social forces in the world. And if they can be brought together, the knowledge of science, the documentation thereof, and the possible solutions to big problems, with the numbers and muscle power and the spiritual and moral fervor, dedication of the religious believers, then a lot can be accomplished. And I believe that will include saving biodiversity, the creation.
Now, you said if, but is there a when? I mean, do you really think it's possible? It's a nice argument. It's a powerful statement, but
I believe that it is eminently possible because in my own background, as I said, I was raised Southern Baptist. I've drifted away a bit. But furthermore, I have already had discussions, preliminary discussions, with evangelists of a wide variety and just casual and in good conversations. I have so far encountered nothing but enthusiasm. And moreover, I think there are lots of signs increasingly commented upon of organized efforts on the part of the mainstream, the great religions, particularly Judeo-Christian, mainstream religions, including evangelicals,
to be
involved in the environment. The problem has so far has been that they haven't picked up on biodiversity, the creation itself, the living environment, and that is the part of the environment, the destruction of which is irreversible.
well, you're quite explicitly in the creation calling to the religious community, to Southern Baptist evangelicals, to come to the environment. And I suspect, because of your background, there are some evangelicals out there that want to bring you, Dr. Wilson, back to Jesus. And I don't know if you're inclined in that direction, but joining us now is Dr. Gerald Durley from Atlanta, Georgia. He's pastor of the Providence Missionary Baptist Church of Atlanta and has been with the church for nearly 20 years. Pastor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure for me to be with you and also for with Dr. Wilson today.
Well, Pastor Durley, meet E.O. Wilson, and he's made a call to people like you, and I'm wondering if that's a message that's likely to be received either by you or your congregation.
First of all, let me say that I have been listening for the last 30 minutes and had an opportunity last night to read the first chapter of the letter, and I want to thank Dr. Wilson for the letter to those of us who are Baptist preachers here in the South, and I had to make a distinction between a Southern Baptist and a Baptist preacher who is in the South. I've been there for a long time, but I want to thank you. And I read the letter with a tremendous amount of optimism, and I have to say that what he's talking about is so very real. One of the things that stood out in my mind is that there are many of us that do not reject the postulates of science. And if the world which God created is to have any kind of sustainability and the reversal of the kinds of trends now, it's absolutely essential for science and religion to work together. It's not an either-or, it's an and-and-both paradigm that is absolutely necessary if we're to live together on this planet, beast and man and animal and insect and whatever else.
Well, Reverend Durley, how did you come to this, and what do your congregations think, or the members of your congregation think about this message?
Well, I think the members, first of all, I think I've said to some people in the last, I'm a recent 9-week-old convert to the whole environmentalist conservationist effort, because in our community, not only the religious community, but the community which I've had an opportunity to work in the last 47 or so years with Dr. King over the years, is that we've been so enamored, first of all, with just the issues of the day in terms of poverty, in terms of health issues, in terms of crime and violence, in terms of, in some instances, in terms of racism. So consequently, issues around the environment and global warming were not as germane to us as possible. But in recent months, we began to look at this and analyze this and understand that one of our roles was that of the Salvation Plan. As Dr. Wilson wrote in his opening about the redeeming factors of Christ, and what we had to do in so many instances when science, and I was a biology major in college, when we reached a point of our finite wisdom and we really didn't understand, whether it's in the scientific world or the social or psychological world, we tried to seek an answer when we would get to our finiteness. And therein we moved into faith, and there is no distinction, we felt, between faith and reason. And in our congregation here, we make a deliberate effort when we reach a certain point where we don't understand, we connect with something that's greater than ourselves. But to that point, we work. We look at what are the numbers, if we're talking about economics, if we're talking about physics, if we're talking about science, and what do they actually reveal? When we reach a certain point, we realize that it's greater than us. And to maintain a certain sense of civility and sanity, we know that there is a God that sits high, that looks low, that will carry us through those moments of darkness. And that's a belief system that carries us. So it is not a denigration of the scientific process nor method, but it's a combination of both. And our membership, which is quite large here, and other congregations which we've had an opportunity to work with, we operate from that vein.
Really? Mm-hmm. So is he speaking your language, Dr. Wilson?
Completely. I would certainly say there is that it's long overdue that secular scientists concerned with these great humanitarian issues offer from their side the hand of friendship to the religious believers, and particularly the evangelicals who represent a source of or have been participants in what have become the culture wars. We can put aside a lot of metaphysical differences that have separated us and meet on common ground. And I would hope that the Reverend Durley. I would expect the Reverend Durley would agree completely with what has been arrived at separately through the scientific exploration of this subject, and that is the close linkage between poverty and destruction of the environment. We cannot hope to save nature, to save the rest of the creation, so to speak, unless we can alleviate the dire condition of the very poor, and especially in the developing countries where most of this is remains. And these people, 1 billion as a whole through the rest of the world, for example, have very little hope of pulling themselves out of their poverty trap unless they can have access to a clean and healthful environment. So the two are very closely linked together. And it seemed to me that this is a domain of a very logical and maybe necessary alliance between people with different worldviews.
Well, I'm hearing some common ground here, and it's not just about geography. Reverend Durley and E.O. Wilson.
Can you hear me now? I was cut off there for a second.
Yeah, I know. You're back, and you're fine, and we want you to stick around and continue this discussion. But I want to bring in Pam from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Pam, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. And Dr. Wilson, thank you for your decades of hard work on behalf of the planet's biodiversity. I'm surprised that, you know, so far the connection between human population growth and the problem of animal and plant extinction hasn't been mentioned. In my relatively short lifetime, I'm not yet 50, world population has more than doubled to 6.5 billion people. And it looks like this year the U.S. population is going to hit 300 million, which is also a doubling in my lifetime. And, you know, and I think that if people could only get the connection, especially in the first world where we have access to, you know, to birth control, that, you know, population growth isn't just a third world problem, it's a first world problem as well because of the amount of resources we use. I could go on, but I'll turn this over to Dr. Wilson.
All right, Pam, thank you very much. Well, you did mention the megafauna problem when humans show up.
Certainly. We know that the root cause of destruction of nature has been human overpopulation. That's a given. And now increasingly as well, increasing per capita consumption. But let me offer just a glimmer of hope here, and that is that generally not known or recognized that as – now, I'm going to sound like a typical liberal Harvard professor here, but I hope I'm speaking straight from a straight database – as women become more independent, country by country, as they gain control of their own lives and especially their reproductive lives, and they have a future that is independent of their immediate family, then the birth rates plummet. Women seem to prefer to have a few quality children as opposed to playing the lottery. And the consequence of this is that although we are now at about 6.5 billion, that's too many, really, to make it comfortable, to sustainably. We are, in fact, heading, according to population estimates from the United Nations centers that study this, we're heading toward about 9 billion before we peak and start coming down. That's 40% more than we have now. We can handle another 40%, but we also, and this becomes more critical.
There'll be a sacrifice if we do, that's for sure.
Well,
I mean, we're already experiencing the sacrifice. Reverend Durley, can the church take any kind of leadership role in an issue as touchy as population control?
I don't think that we have an option. In taking not only about population control, but all of the other issues, the church has commonly had the leadership, and I think Dr. Wilson was alluding to the fact from one of the earlier callers that what is the role? Why hasn't Congress and other places listened to scientists and environmentalists and biologists
as closely as they listen to churches and to the congregations.
Let's take a call. Hazel from Nashville, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say that the attitude that you have, the point of view about life and the union of faith and your attitude toward the earth was something my father instilled in us years ago, and I'm happy to hear that it's made them, well, it's making its way into the news, into the mainstream. I want to support you in that, and I wanted also to say that if we could just get the corporations to understand just how important their relationship to the earth is, how they could make the burden of 9,000 people just a little bit easier on us all.
Well, Hazel, tell me about your dad. What did he used to do, and where did he come from on this ecology question?
Well, actually, he's passed on. He was a Sunday school teacher, and he studied the Bible religiously. And he, strange to say, he was an amateur paleontologist. So he studied nature on a level that most people in the Christian realm don't really consider. And he had told us from a young age that what we learn about science is just the details of creation, and that they should be together. You should understand them as a whole. You should never consider them as opposite.
Well, Hazel, thanks so much for calling. That's great. Let's take another call. Nick is calling from Naugatuck, Connecticut. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that a lot of what I'm hearing, the talks about the extinction of species and the huge human threat, the dangers overcrowding, the fact that we won't be able to feed this population, if you look at the UN reports, if you look at the scientific data that's been gathered on it, it doesn't hold water. An excellent read that I'd recommend to anyone who has any interest in environmentalism, environmental science, is a book by Bjorn Lomborg called The Skeptical Environmentalist. And he became a pariah in the community because he looked around and kind of said, well, yeah, there are problems, but it's not that bad.
Okay, let's get a comment from E.O. Wilson. Nick, stay with us. Go ahead.
I think that there's a good reason why Bjorn Lomborg's book has been rejected virtually unanimously by the serious scientific community, and why, in fact, his own National Academy of Science, or its equivalent, declared the book dishonest. I think that's been rescinded now because they don't want to call him dishonest, but generally that is now rejected. The evidence is simply overwhelming. It's documented in great detail, particularly with the subject I'm most interested in, and that is the decline of biodiversity around the world.
And, you know, the idea that it's not as bad as you're saying, I mean, how do you make that qualitative judgment?
Well, you know, shall we say, as many as 2,000 bird species having been eliminated out of the Pacific Island is not bad for Bjorn, that's a matter of taste, isn't it?
Nick, are you happy to lose 2,000 bird species?
I'm wondering where he's getting that number from.
We are getting it from archaeological remains, sir, dated to the nearest century.
Okay, and what about the massive number of UN reports that estimate the loss of species at much closer to 0.7% for 50 years? That's the UN Global Biodiversity Assessment.
Okay, Nick, let's get an answer. Right.
Okay, well, you could cite Mr. Lomborg's figures. Incidentally, he's never published a paper in Science or on this subject before, all day long. And then I could cite the consensus of figures of the people who are actually doing the scientific research. And where do you suppose that would get us?
Dr. Reverend Durley, when people hear debates among scientists, and whether they're legitimate debates or not, how does it impede people's predilection to take action and really get out there and make change?
I mean, we hear from so many different sides,
from the political persuasion, from the scientific persuasion. And as a pastor, we have the responsibility in many instances of trying to take in all of the data, all of the information, all of the particular viewpoints, and take it from a scriptural point of view. We call it exegeting the text, and give some position for our people to take, whether it's in the political arena or in this particular case, the challenges that I'm facing now, that we're not just facing a heat wave, that there's direct climate changes that are negatively impacting not only the animals and the insects and the biological infrastructure of our country, but of the world, but certainly how does it impact us? So we have the challenge of saying, how does this directly negatively impact you, and what can you do about it? When I think about fossil burning fuel, when I talk about carbon dioxide in the air, when I talk about toxins in children here in the urban areas, I take that, I look at the scriptures, because I have that audience, not just me, but other ministers, and now that we're beginning to have a much greater understanding, because the scientists are beginning to come together in some aspects, we are beginning to take that and translate it so that people can digest it. Just the scientific data does not do too much for the average American out here. But when we can make it live in their own lives in terms of economics, in terms of health, in terms of the political realities, then we can begin to talk about how do we move toward legislation that changes the coal mining, the deforestation as far as taking away trees, and looking toward Detroit in terms of coming up with hybrid automobiles and real practical ways which we can do to preserve the kind of climate that God created. So we have to make that, we call it in our technology a hermeneutical transfer, transferring from what is actually in the scriptures to what we find in the real world and making it live in the lives of the people we're called to serve and to challenge to make not only their spiritual lives better, but their personal, psychological, educational, and physical lives better. So we would be...
All right. Well, sounds like, you know, message received from E.O. Wilson to Pastor Durley here. Let's take another call. Patrick from Buffalo, New York. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks, John, for taking my call. You guys already touched on population, and I was wondering, in terms of natural disasters, earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, hurricanes, you know, whatever, in a broader sense, poverty, I was wondering, Mr. Wilson, if you think that this may be the Earth trying to create some sort of equilibrium, you know, trying to solve the problem that is the human race. And I would ask you, as a 19-year-old who is a little worried about the state of affairs right now, the planet, what I can do on a daily basis to help what the problem is. And also, I would have you appeal to kids my age because, you know, they're just not listening. And while the religious right, you know, like they need to hear it too, just kids my age, they're not listening, and I'm worried about it, and I was wondering what you thought.
The argument actually in the book is directed to you. It's actually a book that contains a lot of the essential facts. It's a short book, so I can't present many of them, but it presents the basic argument and where biology is today and what we know and what we have yet to learn. I think that just getting some of that information, along with the dramatic examples that one can cite of diversity, of the glory of the creation, and the rapidity with which it's disappearing, could be part of the education of the public at large.
What do you think? I mean, I also hear in the words here that you sense some real practical value to congregations every Sunday, not only praying for the people that they pray for in their churches, also praying for the environment, praying for individual species, expressing an explicit sort of love of the creation around them, whether that be the squirrel in the next field or the bird that comes in the spring. Is there a value if people transmitted their spirituality explicitly in the direction of the environment?
I would be outrageously presumptuous if I were to make recommendations of what should be in the magisterium and the messages of our religious leaders. But I do have a passion of my own which is based on the facts and upon what I can only call a spiritual concern, if not conventional religious concern, for the fate of the creation. And yes, I think that the kind of energy and knowledgeability that Reverend Durley has demonstrated has enormous potential power. I think together we actually can change things because, as you well know, politics in the United States, and this is particularly true in an era of micromanagement of polls and opinion and political decision, the political process in this country is from the bottom up, and nothing can be accomplished unless you have a very large percentage of committed citizens who, by whatever channel they express themselves, through the churches, through environmental organizations, personally or otherwise, unless that actually can be summoned. And I believe we can summon it, and I think it will be summoned within a very short period of time.
Well, I think part of the advice to Patrick then is to find an environmental talk-in-the-talk preacher there in Buffalo, New York, join a congregation and get together and, you know, walk the walk and see if there are things that can be done in his own community. Barbara from Northborough, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just to switch gears a little, I had a question for Dr. Wilson. I'm kind of coming from where Reverend Durley is coming from. It seems to me that the mainstream media in the country, and to a certain extent the political agenda, really tends to marginalize and compartmentalize environmental concerns as though they're of little significance, as opposed to the fabric of which we are a part of. And I was wondering if Dr. Wilson had some feedback about that and could mention some additional things that he thinks the average person can do to help move our national agenda to really focus on these issues.
It's one of the critical shortages, I think, in our political life, that we have marginalized the environment, that which just went completely out, for example, of off the table in the last presidential elections. And this could have tragic consequences because it should be right up there with the main issues mentioned in every presidential address and every presidential and other political argument and debate. The source of it is, if I can, I don't want to take too much of a time, but let me give you the historical background in just a few sentences. In the 1960s, the far left took environmental issues as a club and beat the conservatives and the centrists with that, saying that this was an example of the imperfections and the wickedness of capitalist society. By the Reagan years, that club had been wrested back from them, and we found that environmentalism was now a concept that was a club that to beat the left and the liberals with, and then finally the Democratic Party. And that is essentially the kind of stupid battle that we're involved in now at the political level.
Interesting. Reverend Durley, is Katrina an environmental story? I know the science is out on precisely what the mechanisms there are, but does your congregation understand the social deprivation that was revealed by Katrina to be an environmental story on some level?
Yes, we looked at that. In fact, when I talk about the global warming, we were with Andrew Young yesterday, who was touring New Orleans. We've had to adopt about 19 families here in Atlanta. And when we looked at that, when we talk about it, we talk about what global warming has done, the glacier melting, the rays that are coming in and not being reflected back up to the earth, but staying here. So we talk about what happened in Katrina. We also had to take it very realistically because there were conspiracy theories in terms of levees broken away. When you talk to people in their day-to-day pain, they not only want to see hear the scientific explanation, but they also want to know, is this something that has been perpetrated by an insensitive federal government? So we have to walk between that line to say that there has been a level of insensitivity in terms of preparing for the levees, but there's also been a level of sensitivity where greed is involved, where fossil burning fuels have taken place. So we try to explain the whole thing while we're in the middle of alleviating their pain. Many of them have not gone back yet. So we look at it not only from a climate change perspective, but also we've got to educate our legislatures to prepare for this and then educate our overall people as to what we can do.
All right, Reverend Durley, that's not, no, that, that,
an it, incandescent lights. That's something simple I can tell a congregation 2 days from now and how it impacts their direct lives.
All right, we're almost out of time here. I want to get one call in very quickly. Portia from Leverett, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. I know, Professor Wilson, you don't need any more accolades, but I want to add my voice to thanking you so much for this effort on your part. And I remember, as a small child, my father, who was a professor in the Divinity School at Harvard and who did know you, used to take us out to the garden and show us the ant colonies and say to us, and the little plants, and say, there's as much of Christ or gods or religious mystery going on in this tiny patch of garden as there is in the Sistine Chapel. And I think that what I take from that and from you as well is that if we have a personal relationship with the earth, if there's a tree that we are actually able to hug at some point in our life or climb and be glad we can climb it, that we will respond much more to the issue, the urgency of the issue that you're putting before us.
Portia, thanks so much for calling. That's a very sweet note to end on, really. Go ahead, Dr.
Yeah,
Wilson.
Well, very briefly then, not to intrude on Reverend Early's territory, but bless you.
Oh, that's great. Dr. Gerald Durley, thank you very much for joining us from Atlanta.
Thank you so much.
And
Dr.
He's
Wilson, we look forward to being working with you.
All right. I look forward to
get down
to
there. Do a
you.
Sermon, you know. Dr. Gerald Durley is pastor at Providence Missionary Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. He's been there for 20 years. And, of course, E.O. Wilson's new book is called The Creation, An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. E.O. Wilson, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm John Hockenberry for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.